you're listening to Magnifico Radio, and I'm your host, Kate Black. Each week, I sit down with leaders, makers, and designers at the forefront of sustainability to discuss their journeys and motivation. Whether it's ethical fashion, clean beauty, or sustainable products, they're all doing something Magnifico. This show is made possible with support from our sponsors like Queen of Raw, the independent designer's destination for raw materials at ridiculously low prices. For the latest in innovative and sustainable fabrics with low minimums, visit queenofraw.com. Today's guest had a great plan to create Africa's first fair trade certified apparel manufacturing facility in the country of his birth, the West African nation of Liberia. A country recovering from civil war, and he just wanted to be part of the rebuilding. Jid Liberty founded Liberty and Justice, purchased sewing machines, hired local women as tailors, and envisioned selling Made in Liberia t-shirts in the United States. And then Ebola broke out. But he's not called a social innovation rock star for nothing. I'm excited to introduce you to Jid Liberty, who is making fashion do good in the world. Hi, Jid.
Hey, Kate. How are you?
I'm well, thanks. So let's start at the beginning. How did you go from earning an undergraduate degree in management information systems and accounting from the University of Wisconsin-Madison to deciding I'm going to build an apparel factory in Liberia?
Well, school played a very little part in my journey. As you can tell by what I was studying, I studied, you know, finance and accounting and management information systems. And that was kind of the big program at my school at the time, but I didn't really spend a lot of time in school. quite frankly, I started a company when I was 16 and sold that company when I was 19 during basically the latter half of my freshman year of school, and, you know, had to work for the surviving company for a couple of years.
Was that in fashion?
I was actually in entertainment. I was a management company. I managed artists. So I continued to manage, and then moved out to the West Coast after my contract was done with those guys, and was interested with one of my professors in starting a tech company. And we worked on that company for a few months, and just really wasn't going anywhere. And so I made a quick pivot and decided, why don't I work on the things that I learned in school finally, and started working in tech, and actually took a very short stint back in the management business with a rapper who was signed to DreamWorks at the time called Prozac, but then got really heavily focused on finance and on tech, and worked for some pretty amazing companies, all pretty young companies, from Camelback at the time to Mindjet and Trilogy. And then I kind of just got the bug.
What era or what year?
Between 2000 and 1 is when I moved to California. So like the end of 2001, all the way through 2009.
Yeah, so tech was having its second moments in those years.
Yeah. And like a lot of great startups, we're up, of course, working in the city and in the valley, but also working up in like Petaluma and Telecom Valley, in Marin. And so we had a really, my friends at the time had a really amazing time sort of working for a lot of great companies. But I got the itch to go and start reconnecting with my Liberian side that I'd been sort of torn away from since I was a little child, and just was really curious about what was going on in Liberia and how I could potentially contribute.
And so what made you think that fashion was going to be that great vehicle to kind of contribute, build business, build kind of a sustainable infrastructure at a time when jobs were needed? What called to you? Why not tech? Like, why fashion and not tech?
Yeah, good question. I mean, I would say that I really wasn't looking at it from a fashion perspective as much as from an industrialization perspective. And so, you know, for me, I went back to Liberia and I started meeting with all these women's groups that were part of the Liberian Women's Peace Movement, which later won the Nobel Peace Prize, but at this time, not a whole lot of people knew about the peace movement. We were trying to sort out what kind of project we could do together. I actually thought that we would start a microfinance institution. Time I had a background in finance and thought that I'd be a good lender. So I thought, all right, well, that's kind of the answer. And when I got on the ground, there was already a pretty saturated market for microfinance. They really didn't need me there at all. They were great institutions doing much better work than I ever could have. But what was really missing was jobs. Just people just wanted to go someplace and work an 8-hour day and get a paycheck. And Liberia had an 80% unemployment rate and an 80% poverty rate. And so my feeling was, you know, the most valuable thing that I could do is create jobs. And I know a little bit about that, given my background with startups. So can I come here and create jobs? And I've been usually working in things like entertainment or tech. Apparel manufacturing was basically pretty low tech. But I felt that it could create a lot of jobs and provide opportunities for women who haven't had a formal education. And so, I think I've always had a personal interest in fashion, but I never really saw myself becoming a fashion entrepreneur like I am today. But at the time, I was thinking about it more from the job creation and manufacturing standpoint than I was looking at thinking about things like design and branding.
And I was reading, was that self-funded when you kind of started to make that foray? Because I'd read that you'd raised $3 million and Ashley Bush, who's Lauren Bush's sister, announced that she would use the factory. But was that pre-Ebola, like before you had started rolling, or was that in one of the subsequent factories?
No, that was all just as we got going. I mean, yeah, my business partner Adam and I sort of self-financed the first few trips to Liberia. Again, we didn't really have, we had nothing. We really had an idea. And after my first trip, actually, I went to the Magic Trade Show in Las Vegas because somebody recommended I go because I literally knew nothing about the apparel industry. Went to a meeting there and bumped into a lady who'd just given a talk, Nicole, who'd become a good friend. I just basically, you know, asked her for information and told her what I was thinking about doing. And I think the signals got a little crossed because she reappeared in my life a few months later. I'm totally remembering everything that I told her, but it sounded like she believed that I already had this factory on the ground. And so she was actually the head of sustainability at Prana. And so she says to me, hey, we got this new fair trade t-shirt program we're going to launch, and we want to launch it with you. Fantastic. The only problem is I have no factory yet. And so we were able to sort of get going very, very, very quickly, propelled by this deal with Prana to be their fair trade t-shirt supplier. And then things just really accelerated very, very quickly. Other buyers came to the table. People like Feed, who was Lauren Bush Lauren's organization, through her sister Ashley, who's a really good friend of mine. So things kind of like took off very quickly. And that's when we ended up raising a good chunk of capital, probably about $4.6 million altogether.
And so how long was the business in business before Ebola started to really shift the perspective of what was going to happen?
So basically from 2010 to 2014, we were running at 1,000,000 miles an hour. After those deals with, you know, Prana and Seed, and then we had a bunch of work that we did for a bunch of different UN agencies and USAID to make T-shirts. You know, sometimes they're, you know, I want to call them like propaganda T-shirts, you know, don't use the bathroom without washing your hands. But we would make all those T-shirts for all these NGOs. And we had a really, really great business. And then surprisingly, one day a reality TV star who's now become a really great friend, Whitney Port from the show The City in the Hills, came to the factory in Liberia. She was doing some charity work in Africa. And she and her father and her sister fell in love with the factory. And her dad brought us up to a good buddy of his, who happened to have just bought the clothing company Haggar. Long story short, within a couple of weeks, we had an agreement with Haggar to manufacture like 250,000 units a month. And just to give you an idea of what that meant for us in terms of scales, we were doing about 200,000 units a year. So we really needed to scale up quickly. Interestingly enough, within another month, we signed another one of these agreements. So now we're up to, you know, almost 500,000 units a month that we had to produce. And so we had to scale our factory pretty quickly. We built a new place that's 2.5 years. So basically 4 years in, we have a new factory. We got a lot more workers. We're cranking at 1,000,000 miles an hour. And then the Ebola outbreak happened and basically shut us down completely.
All right. So that seems like a very good place to take a break. So we're going to take a quick break and then come back and find out how you pivoted again. Today's episode is made possible through the support of our sponsor, Bank & Vogue, global leaders in the innovative and relevant solutions to the crisis of stuff. The family business is one of the largest brokers and agents of used goods in North America. With the addition of their new manufacturing facility, they can create on-demand, on-trend items using your post-consumer branded goods. Interested in unique solutions to waste that your customers and sustainability officer will love? Visit bankvogue.com to learn more. So this is Kate Black, and you're listening to Magnifico Radio. And today I'm talking to Chid Liberty from Liberty and Justice and the Uniform Project. So before the break, we were talking about how business was coming together perfectly. Everybody's in love with the Liberian, Made in Liberian project, and then Ebola hits. So where were you, A, when the outbreak happened, and B, what happened to the business?
So I was in Liberia when the first inklings of Ebola started to appear in Lofa County, which is out where my family's farm is, about a 10-hour drive from Monrovia, not because it's very far, but just because it's a little dirt road. So, you know, at first we started hearing about Ebola and we didn't really think it was a big deal at all. It sounded pretty bizarre, quite frankly. There'd never been anything like that in Liberia as far as we'd known. And so we thought maybe this was just some sensational, weird news in Liberian newspapers. And then, as you know, a couple weeks later, Ebola was in Monrovia. Of course, that was a little bit scarier. Our workers lived in slums, sometimes, you know, 75,000 people on a quarter square mile piece of land. And so it was pretty dangerous should somebody, you know, within their neighborhood get infected. It would probably spread rather quickly. And so we started to worry mostly for our workers, but then, you know, personally, I'd moved my ex-girlfriend at the time from LA, she's my girlfriend at the time, sorry, to Monrovia. And so she was living in Monrovia and she got sick. I just flown in a new mechanic from Sri Lanka who was setting up a lot of the new machinery that we had upgraded to. And he got sick. So I had two really important people to me who were sick and couldn't take them to any clinic because they were all shut down because of the Ebola outbreak. I mean, doctors were dying. Doctors were dying, and it was a pretty terrible, terrible time. And so,
when they got sick with Ebola, or they just had a coincidental secondary illness?
They did not get sick with Ebola. But at the time, we couldn't really tell anything. All we knew is that the doctor knew that it likely was not Ebola, but they both had terrible, terrible headaches. And so it was just a scary thing because you couldn't really get them any good medical care in Liberia. and anywhere that you'd want to take them was now becoming an Ebola holding center. So it's almost like you would be taking them to the virus, you know? And so, it was just a really, really scary time for me. We decided that we would actually leave the country for a couple weeks and shut down the factory for a few weeks just to give the government time to get a hold of what was in there. It's almost getting weird and, you know, post-apocalyptic. Long story short, we got out of Liberia thinking that we'd be returning in 10 to 14 days. We let the workers stay home for a couple of weeks so that they could be safe. And 3 days into being in Europe, we learned on the cover of New York Times that Liberia declared a state of emergency. It was now going to be illegal for us to assemble people within our factory. And we were kind of stuck in this bizarre limbo land for then months and months.
Oh, my goodness. And so fast forwarding to the fact that all of your workers survived,
yeah.
Right? You didn't have any fatalities within your workforce.
Yeah, we didn't even have any infections or anything. We had no cases of Ebola, which, again, is pretty miraculous because all of them live in some of the slums of Monrovia. About 70%, 75% of them live in the slum. That was like on the cover of the New York Times. So the fact that they were able to keep safe is pretty miraculous.
And so how did you decide that the organization or that the business needed to pivot and that you needed to continue manufacturing, stay on the continent, but move out of Liberia for the time being?
Well, we actually...
Oh, you didn't leave, right?
Yeah, no. Our factory's open today. They're making school uniforms.
So you didn't start production, because I know that you're also producing in other countries. So you didn't start production in other countries as a supplemental line during this time? You just waited it out?
Yeah. Well, no, what we did was first we just waited out Ebola for 9 months. And we had already been working on a concept to bring in other factories into our manufacturing network. And so that kind of side project was already underway because we wanted to be able to provide more production capacity for our clients. So we were already working on more factories in different countries. And then 9 months after the Ebola outbreak, we got back on the ground. And as you can imagine, the workers are sort of chomping at the bit to get back to work because, you know, we were able to provide them some cash stipends and stuff like that. But it wasn't like, you know, their full salary while we were shut for 9 months. And so so everybody just wants to get back to work. Everybody wants to see the family again. And, you know, they're just really excited. And unfortunately, our customers weren't as excited. We couldn't get them to come and place more orders in Liberia. So we were kind of stuck in one of those positions where, you know, the workers kind of don't understand, you know, what's going on. We just want to. So I was in the factory with them and actually one of our investors just talking through different things that we might be able to do. We could start our own pants business. We could, you know, we had all of this fabric that was in our warehouse that had been there for the entire Ebola outbreak from these canceled orders. So, like, what do we do with all this dead stock fabric? What do we do to get the workers back to work? And I had done a lot of research actually on the school uniform business because it's a gigantic business in West Africa. It's probably about a $5 billion business a year in West Africa. And so I thought, hey, guys, why don't we start a school uniform business? I mean, local market, sure, our uniforms are better than what people are bringing in terms of quality. And, you know, we could likely be competitive on price. We can't be as cheap as some of the Chinese goods that are coming in. But they said there's no way that we could do that business because they were the women who still had a job in the country, and they didn't have money to buy school uniforms. So how was the rest of the country going to be?
So you had this great idea, And this perfect way to use the dead stock material, use the staff, use all the equipment that's sitting in Liberia to create a domestic product. School uniforms for everybody in West Africa. But after the Ebola outbreak, there's no money to buy school uniforms.
Yeah. In Liberia, they said, well, we're going to start selling here, and there's no market. There's a huge demand, but nobody has the money to buy that. And so I started thinking, this is a really big problem because there's public education in Liberia that's compulsory and free, supposedly. A big reason parents don't send their kids to school is because they can't afford the uniform. And,
So you can study in school in Liberia for free, but you must, as a student, be in uniform.
You have to be in uniform. And this is not just true for Liberia. This is true for basically every country that I've seen in Africa and most countries in the developing world. You have to be in uniform. Like, it's just a thing. And so, basically, schools had been shut down in Liberia for a year because of the Ebola outbreak. And I was not interested at all in seeing more kids left out of school, especially because, like, the year before, 100% of the kids who took the university entrance exam had failed it in Liberia. So, like, we need kids in school. Liberia already had a really low school enrollment rate. It kind of became a thing of, like, well, how can we help? Like, we have this factory. We have all this dead stock fabric. How can we be sort of a force for good in this situation? And I thought, like, well, why don't we figure out a way to give away the uniforms for free? Wouldn't that be really powerful? It's like sort of our gift to Liberia coming out of Ebola. We're just going to give away a ton of free uniforms.
And were you intimidated by, like, because the kind of the biggest and most well-known buy one, give one program is the Tom's Shoes. And it's been met with kind of some good press and some good feedback. But then there was this whole kind of pushback about a buy one, give one not being a suitable program. So weren't you a little intimidated by the marketplace's perception of those kind of programs?
I actually was, because I've been one of the complainants, early on, especially when a lot of the goods were being manufactured in China and sort of dumped in Africa, that wasn't really our way to get sustainable development. But as I was saying this to the women in the factory, as I was like, well, there is the opportunity for us to pay for this by launching our own brand. And there is this thing called the one-for-one program. I told them in that case that most of the time, some people complain that the things being given away aren't being made locally. But in our case, number one, I think it's arguable whether or not shoes are sort of an important thing to give people in sort of the development world. By that, I don't mean in the developing world. I mean, among development wonks, some people feel that, giving kids shoes is just putting a Band-Aid on the problem. We need to figure out what the systemic issues are that give them a lack of shoes or a lack of whatever it is that they need to move forward. And so I completely agree with that. Like, I like to look at things from the systems level. That said, if we are to give kids anything in this world, here's why I think uniforms are really powerful. MIT actually did research that showed that when you donate a school uniform, attendance goes up by up to 62%. Test scores go up. And for every three young girls that get the donated school uniform, two will delay their first pregnancy. So to me, if we have MIT research that shows that we're going to get more kids in school, better attendance, higher test scores, and lower teenage pregnancy rates, seems like a pretty good thing to give away. So that was like my first thing that we solved. That's giving away uniforms. Second part is, the complaint about Tom's is like, all right, you're taking shoes that are made in China, giving them away for free, and putting a local shoemaker out of it. Totally get that. And in fact, one of my friends brought this up to me. Well, what are you doing? You're displacing all the local tailors. Well, I had 300 local tailors on my payroll, so we're not displacing anybody. We're just a great company that hires a lot of great people who are now making the product. So for us, moms are getting jobs, kids are getting education, and we see that as a win-win-win for everybody.
I love it. And Nylon Magazine, I think, wrote the kind of best description about it, it said, not only are the pieces well-designed and true to uniform's identity, they're a chance to indulge both your hype beast and humanist sides.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. In fact, I reposted that as sort of the first person who I feel really understands me, because I think I'm both very much hype beast and humanist.
And for people who don't know hype beast, and now that I know that you have an entertainment background, it all makes sense, because you do a lot of collaborations with rappers. There's a lot of kind of street aesthetic about the collections. And so was that always your plan, or is that just really trying to meet the market where you think it needs to be met?
Well, what's really funny about that, Kate, is, like, be honest with you, it wasn't my original plan. But as you know, I'm a huge Tony Robbins fan, and Tony Robbins, when he talks about entrepreneurs, always says that, like, you know, you should never try to start a business against your nature, because your nature is always going to come out. So if you're really extroverted, you know, don't become a CPA, and you know, it's not going to work. And so similarly, I think that, I really kind of had some of the elements, of course, of street infused design and of minimalism sort of in the brand that I think we were originally creating. But naturally, just because of my network and my own sensibilities and my sort of relationships and my understanding of the world, what kind of kept coming out was this more street-oriented brand. And it was more people, you know, people had to tell me that we were a streetwear brand. I didn't even really know. Like, the first time I heard we were a streetwear brand was, like, from a VC and from Vogue, who were like, typical streetwear. And I was like, oh, okay, I guess that's what we are. Kind of doing things that I thought were really cool. And to be honest with you, I thought they were very extreme. When we talk about our inner hype beasts, obviously there's sort of like the whole streetwear and sneakerhead culture. And I'm very much a sneakerhead. I very much love to collect a rare pair of Jordans, or, you know, right now I'm wearing Margiela's, which are some of my favorite sneakers. And actually, we started thinking through really cool design collaborations that we could do organically, just because I knew his manager. We ended up connecting with ASAP Ferg, who, along with being an amazing, world-recognized platinum-selling rapper, is also a fashion designer, you know, intern for Jay at Rockaware. I used to work with his dad for Bad Boy and do all the t-shirt for Bad Boy. And Sean John, when his dad was still alive and Diddy was still doing it New York street style. And so Ferg is an incredible fashion designer. And so we connected, and he just loved the idea of what we're doing. He'd always wanted to work in the developing world with folks. And so we launched first collaboration with him and his brand Traplord. In fact, this Friday, August 18th, we have a pop-up shop in New York, in Soho, for the weekend. That's going to be a Traplord uniform pop-up shop. And right now the line is available exclusively in Bloomingdale's until then. On the 18th, it's also available on our website. And then we kind of loved working together so much that we have as our creative director for Uniform. So we're going to be seeing a lot more of design work from Ferg over the next couple years.
You've brought him on as the creative director.
Yeah, so ASAP Ferg is our creative director.
Oh my goodness. Okay, and so because this show's not going to go live until I think September or maybe even October,
yeah.
Can we talk about what's coming next, or what's going to be, like, what's leading up to holiday and what... Where people can find the brand and get more involved?
What's coming next for us is, you know, ASAP Ferg has signed on for as our creative director. And what's really cool about that is, number one, all the cool ideas that I think and sort of design direction from Ferg. But we both Ferg and I, see Uniform as a platform for other creatives, and especially for people who come out of hip hop and street culture. And so we've talked to a lot of different people, and there's some really amazing collaborations I can't really announce right now, but I think you'll see a lot of really great capsules coming out from some of your favorite artists and actors and whatever. And then you'll also see us just continuously improving our core collection of joggers and t-shirts and hoodies and dresses and bombers and all that. So the line right now for men exists at Bloomingdale's and on the Bloomingdale's site and on our website, shopuniform.com. And for women, it's exclusively on.
And where can people find the line?
Exclusively on shopuniform.com. And then starting in September, we will be also available on Amazon.
Wow.
You can't beat them, join them.
Exactly. So I need to ask you this because we're running out of time, but I just want to know, ethical fashion and reasonable prices, how are you able, and plus providing uniforms for a whole generation of kids, how are you able to do it?
Well, I think for us, we were building a company that was focused on getting American buyers to buy from us. And so sort of getting to low-cost manufacturing was always a big thing for us. And we really saw that Africa provided this very unique opportunity in the world to do this. Number one, there weren't any duties coming out of Africa because of the African Growth and Opportunity Act. Number two, we like to keep a lot of the stuff vertical. So all the shipping costs and time that happens shipping cotton from one place to another place to get milled to another place, to get cut and sewn, we kind of cut all that out. And so that cut, again, cost. And so we just kept, we were building the supply chain for other companies that were really price conscious. But when we launched our own brand, we had already sort of mastered, low cost manufacturing that was still really ethical and paying above average wages and making sure that farmers were getting premiums and able to build a good life for their families. So we kind of already were building this, farm to fashion or seed to store or whatever we want to say, dirt to shirt, we like to say sometimes. We were building that for other companies. And then when we could sort of turn it on for ourselves, instead of selling, not to give away our customers' margins, but instead of selling a t-shirt to them, for $4 and change, which they went around to sell for $48, sell that t-shirt now for $28 ourselves, save the customer $20, and still be making a lot more money.
Will you please come back when you can talk about the great exciting news that you have to share?
I will absolutely come back and just really appreciate all the work that you do sort of spreading the good word and about all these great companies making change in the world. And so, anytime, I'd be happy to join you anywhere.
Okay, great. So that's been Chid Liberty from Liberty and Justice and also the Uniform Project. And that's another episode of Magnifico Radio. Thank you for listening. And if you like what you hear, kindly give us a review or a rating. It'll help us rank higher amongst conventional fashion and beauty podcasts. And don't forget to subscribe. You don't want to miss next week's episode when I talk to Romain Gaillard, the co-founder of the Detox Market. Special thanks to Steve Ballstedt for engineering, co-producing, and providing all the music, which you can find on iTunes under Metro Jesus. Until next week.